Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Merlin A. Hermes, who has a novel, The Lunatic, The Lover, and The Poet, also the author of an earlier novel, Careful What You Wish For. Merlin Hermes has a very interesting past, which we'll go into in a few moments. This particular book is a Shakespeare mashup, I guess you'd call it. There's a subtitle, Shakespeare Turned Topsy-Turvy, which may or may not be yours. Let me start by asking you a little bit about yourself, and then we'll move into the book gradually. You were born in 1975, and your parents were in a group called The Fool, is that correct?
The Gestalt Fool, I think, is what their formal title was. It was a sort of hippie theater collective that was housed in a big San Francisco mansion where they slept two or three to a room. And my parents met there in sort of unusual circumstances, I guess. My mother was married to another man at the time, and things seemed to be a little fluid in The Fool.
This was a group that opened up for people like, I think, the Grateful Dead at some point.
I guess, yeah. I only know what I've heard from the reunions. I didn't really grow up on Fool stories, but the next generation is still pretty close.
Obviously, the children of boomers or pre-boomers have an interesting past, but your parents came out of the heart of San Francisco hippiedom. As you were growing up, that meant that your life kind of had different value system from the lives of most people growing up in America.
I suppose so. I mean, in a way, I never felt typically American. We lived in India for a while. My parents, this was after I was born, so I remember it a little bit better, even though I was only about four or five. We lived in India on a commune there, and then moved to Maui, where my parents had separated by that point, and my mother and stepfather ran a organic produce farm, and my father designed and built sets for the local children's theater, and so I got my start in theater at a pretty early age and was in plays pretty much all the time.
But at some point you moved over into writing. You studied theater, though, in college, right?
Yeah, I was doing both all the way up through college. I intended to become an actor, but I found that what I ended up working on the most and what I enjoyed most about acting was going deeply into the text and really writing all of the backstory of the character and their interior thoughts. And I really overthought it too much to be a good actress, because instead of physically inhabiting, I was thinking about it so much. And so it's kind of funny that, in a way, this book, The Lunatic, The Lover, and The Poet, is in a way my production of Hamlet or my performance of Hamlet. Because when you play Hamlet or when you put Hamlet on the stage, people don't come to see the play itself. They come to see the backstory and the history behind it and how you're going to do the character and how the actor is going to play the role. So in a way, this is almost like a non-theatrical production of Hamlet that I've directed and put all the backstory to.
Well, we'll get to that in a moment, because what you say has some very interesting elements to it. You wound up getting a degree from Reed College, and then you studied creative writing in London. Is that correct?
Yes, I went to the University of London to study with Andrew Motion, who was poet laureate at the time. He was starting a new program at Royal Holloway College. When I sent him my stuff, people read this, and most of them responded to it going, "What is this?" But he really understood it. He knew Hamlet very, very well and knew the sonnets very well. And he sent me a really nice email saying, "What you're doing will be different from most of the other writers on the course, but I would like to have you in the class." And so I went over there and studied with him for a couple of years.
Was it then during that period when you began working on your first novel, Careful What You Wish For?
I wrote my first novel when I was at Reed. It was my English thesis. I was a double major in English and theater there. And so I petitioned to do a creative thesis. I did two creative theses, actually, because my theater thesis was a production of The Cherry Orchard. For my English thesis, I wrote a novel. then the year or two after I graduated, I revised it and found an agent. And so that was published soon after I graduated from college.
You were 23 at the time. So there's been quite a 12-year gap now between that book and this one.
Just about, but that's writing and also the publishing of it, which has taken a while.
Let's talk a little about The Lunatic, The Lover, and The Poet. At what point did you suddenly get the urge to go to Shakespeare and see what you could come up with? How did that come about?
Well, I've always read Shakespeare. I've been reading Shakespeare, you know, since I was a child. I've performed in a lot of Shakespeare plays as well. In high school, we used to have an annual sort of Shakespeare festival called Live Tonight at the Globe, which was a bunch of different Shakespeare scenes sort of strung together with fairly flimsy plot, usually. In a way, all of that influenced me and how I look at Shakespeare, and I think performing in the plays is the thing that gets people familiar enough with the lines to be able to play with them the way I do and take them apart and put them in new context, because when you're doing a play, the actors will do that backstage all the time. They'll throw around the lines out of context and make up parodies and songs. So it's very very much an in-joke for theater lovers and actors as well.
But what exactly made you sit down at your computer that first day and start working on the book?
Well, originally it started out as Gertrude's story. I wanted to write Hamlet from Gertrude's point of view, basically, and that started with an exercise I'd done in an acting class, inhabiting the character of Gertrude, when basically the sin, assuming that she doesn't know about the murder, her only sin is that she's still sexually active and lustful at her age, imagine. And we see the play usually through Hamlet's eyes, and he's somewhat disgusted with his mother's behavior. I've since found, actually, that Margaret Atwood has a fantastic short story called Gertrude Talks Back that's the closet scene from her point of view. And you see, well, sure, maybe Claudius wasn't as handsome as your father, but he likes to have a laugh now and again.
Two things come to mind there. First of all, of course, was John Gardner's Grendel, which is the Beowulf story from the point of view of the monster. But also there's a small sequence in The Lunatic, The Lover, and The Poet from Gertrude's point of view. Is that small sequence where we learn about Hamlet's father, is that small sequence what remains of that original
tale?
Pretty
much. About 150 pages of my first draft, which was mostly Gertrude, and then Hamlet and Horatio came in as a subplot to that. I had been working on the first draft for about a year, I'd say, when John Updike's Gertrude and Claudius came out. Even though what he does is very different in a lot of ways from what I do with the text, I was sort of smacked by that into, well, I can't come out and tell Gertrude's story. And I was already starting to get a little bit bored with telling that tale anyway, because it was very similar to my first book, Careful What You Wish For, which was the tale of a woman in an unhappy marriage, and she has sort of a troubled relationship with her son, who's sort of an introverted thinking type. And Gertrude, even though she was a 16th century queen in my interpretation, emotionally, it was sort of retreading the same ground I'd already covered. And I was already starting to get more interested in this subplot between Hamlet and Horatio.
That subplot is a gay subplot. I mean, was it from the beginning then?
Well, I started out with the idea that Horatio was in love with Hamlet. And that, I think, is a lot more supported by the text. Hamlet is always ambiguous. What he says to Gertrude is ambiguous. What he says to Ophelia is ambiguous. He says one thing to Horatio and then turns around and sort of negates it. So, and that, I think, is the strength in Hamlet, because it opens up so many doors to play it so many different ways. But Horatio, I think you can read a lot more clearly as having a romantic interest in Hamlet. He leaves his position at Wittenberg as a scholar. He comes to Denmark. He knows no one there but Hamlet. Clearly, he's not native to the ground. He basically gives up everything for Hamlet and admits as much in the first scene when he shows up. Then later on, when the letter comes from Hamlet, he says he can think of no one else in the world who would write to him if not Hamlet. And when Hamlet is dying at the end, he actually tries to kill himself. He tries to take the poison cup and drink poison. And it's very similar to the end of Romeo and Juliet in that way. So I started with that, and then I started looking at the sonnets as a sort of backstory, because Horatio ends up as the author figure of Hamlet in a way, because he's the one who's told at the end to report my story, and because he's the scholar and is often shown carrying around the big book, and so he becomes kind of the Shakespeare figure. And so I started looking at the story of the sonnets and seeing Hamlet as this hero, the fair young man who everyone admires and looks up to, even though his behavior is often somewhat questionable. And so once I started looking at the sonnets, the plot sort of fell into place, and the sonnets in a way took over until there's at least as much of the sonnets in here as there is Hamlet.
Which meant bringing in the Dark Lady.
Yes. She's sort of my non-Shakespearean character. The Dark Lady is an interesting figure in Shakespeare, because of all of Shakespeare's heroines, she's the only one who we don't get to hear from. We hear her say, "I hate," and then "not you," in one of the sonnets, and that's pretty much all we get of her voice. So I wanted to bring in her voice, but also in this metaphorical way, if the relationship between Hamlet and Horatio was of the muse or the hero and the author, then she became the reader who directs the story and ends up controlling it, because she is the one who will take it and do with it what she will.
When we're reading the book, should we take it as historical fiction or as an alternate historical fiction?
It's not a historical fiction in that this is really the history of 16th century Wittenberg. It's historical in the same way that the original is historical. I mean, the original is not really about a Danish prince so much as it is about Elizabethan England and its own time. It's a little bit more of a postmodern historical in a way, sort of like Umberto Eco or Jeanette Winterson has these historical fantasies that don't really take place in the real world. It's an explicitly fictionalized text.
Could we take it, though, that perhaps in the world of your book, Merlin Hermes, in that world, Horatio did write the play that we see today as Hamlet, and it's performed?
Well, I guess that is the assumption, but I don't think you can draw really a historical reality in that way from the book. The relationship of the book to our world isn't like there's an alternate history in which Horatio is Shakespeare and Shakespeare doesn't exist. In a way, Shakespeare pops up in this book in many ways. He's Horatio's long-lost father. He's the old man in the pub whose name no one can pronounce or remember. I don't know if it comes across or if people are necessarily expecting that sort of a historical novel.
In terms of Horatio and Hamlet having an affair, subtext and homosexuality are linked through most of our cultural history. You've chosen Horatio and Hamlet. Do you see that same subtext beyond the sonnets in other plays?
I think there are a few characters who have close relationships with other men, and I don't think it's that unusual for the world that Shakespeare was in at the time. You have to remember that he was involved in the theater, and there was all sorts of gender play and gender bending, not only in his plays, but in the theater world itself. There's Antonio from Merchant of Venice is often said to have a pretty close relationship with Bassanio, I think it is. I think Mercutio you could definitely read as possibly having some sort of unrequited thing for Romeo. But I don't think it's quite as overt as in, say, the works of Marlowe, who was very open about loving tobacco and boys.
When Horatio was first confronted by Hamlet kind of coming on to him, his response is that, "Oh my God, no. I mean, this is just so beyond the pale." And yet I wonder, in that day, do we have any idea whether it was, actually was or wasn't, or are you kind of just going with the idea that Horatio would not necessarily see that?
Well, all of that is taken straight from the sonnets, really. The emotional journey that Horatio goes through is the journey of the sonnets. I think the sonnets show bisexuality, if anything. Most of the strong eroticism is surrounding the Dark Lady. And the Fair Young Man, there's a very sensual and passionate relationship with. But there is the sonnet where he says, "But since she pricked thee out for women's pleasure, mine be thy love and thy love's use their treasure." Now, some later sonnets seem to contradict that. There's a great book by Joseph Picanee called Such Is My Love that goes through all the sonnets and explains all of the Elizabethan slang and the sexual imagery in them. And that seems to suggest that there was at least some sexual contact between the poet and the fair young man. At the time, of course, there wasn't really the concept of homosexuality the way that we have it now. There were libertines who would sleep with anyone. That was unacceptable, except for the few people who managed to get away with it, such as the aforementioned Kit Marlowe. There was sort of an underground gay scene. I've done some research a little bit later on. I'm working now on a book about Aphra Behn, the first female playwright from the Restoration, which is a little bit later in the 1660s and 70s. And there were raids on Molly clubs as early as the 17th century, which were these private clubs where men would get together and all sorts of shenanigans would go on. They would have these very ritualized shows where they would dress up as women, and one would pretend to give birth to a baby. And so there's this sort of elaborate culture that emerges in the 17th century and definitely in the 18th. As to whether that was going on underground, I've read some theories that it only emerges then because that was when they were really cracking down on it legally. These sorts of clubs and things have been going on for years in London, at least.
Drag clubs in Elizabethan London.
Yeah, well, Elizabethans were the first drag queens. You know, it was all the boys playing girls' roles. And Shakespeare really plays with that, especially in As You Like It and Twelfth Night, where he has the girls dress up as boys, but it's a boy playing a girl who dresses as a boy in As You Like It. And I play with that a little bit by having As You Like It be the play that Hamlet plays in, dressed up as the heroine Rosalind, which is funny because Rosalind has been called sort of the female Hamlet. And in a way, the characters are very similar. They're both mourning, Rosalind's mourning the exile of her father, and Hamlet's mourning his father's death. They have the cruel uncle, and just sort of the twists and turns that they take that leads one to be a comedy and one a tragedy. Shakespeare really likes to play with gender in a way that we don't see a lot, at least in mainstream theater these days.
Careful What You Wish For takes place 1949, 1950, so it's more or less contemporary dialogue. When you're dealing with Elizabethan era, obviously you need to deal with the language of the time, but at the same time you need to make it accessible. In creating the voice of Horatio and in creating the voice of the other characters, did you find that easy, difficult?
Well, I think the hardest part about writing the novel was kind of finding the voice and finding the genre and what sort of tone it would take. And I didn't want to do all of the these and thous and straight Elizabethan language, but I try to unpack Shakespeare's text somewhat. Rather than translating it into modern speech, like a lot of editions will do these days, I tried to make what he does with the language accessible. There's one line where I say, "You can see him now, an affable, familiar ghost who nightly gulls your gullible ear with strange intelligence." And that's out of the sonnet, "Who nightly gulls me with intelligence." But I put in the word gullibility there so that people will hear gulls and get where that comes down to our modern word. And people will understand the image that's being used and try to see how Shakespeare came to that image in a way.
Well, were you worried too much about in-jokes?
I didn't really worry about that. I guess I was writing it for the people who would get the in-jokes.
It took a long time. What's the history of the publishing When did you start the book, and what happened? I mean, we're talking 12 years here.
I had a draft of the novel, not the exact draft that ended up published, but I had a full and finished draft of the novel done by 2005. That was when I came back from England. And I sent it around to various agents in London and gotten a lot of people wanting to read my next book, but saying, oh, no one will publish this, and gay fiction is hard to sell, historical fiction with a male protagonist is hard to sell, etc., etc. And also a lot of, well, I loved it, but the general reader won't get all of the jokes. So I sort of put it on the shelf, and I'd gotten a grant while in England to write this novel about Afra Behn, and so I was working on that, and the Arch and Bruce Brown Prize was for a gay-themed historical novel, so I sent it in. When I won that, it sort of gave me the impetus to take it off the shelf and start sending it around to some more agents. I finally found the editor, Rakesh Satyal, who had published a bisexual historical novel previously, Anne Herendeen's Phillida and the Brotherhood of Philander, and I knew that looking at his history and what the sort of stuff he had published, that he would really like this book, but he needed an agent to submit it. So I submitted to all of the agents who had sold to him recently. And finally, I signed my agent, Mitchell Waters, and he sent it out to his various stable of people. And it was Rakesh Satyal who ended up making the offer and publishing it.
And that's at Harper Perenny.
Which is funny because I sent an email to Rakesh 2 years previously, but the way the publishing industry works, you have to kind of go through all of the gates in order to make it.
The story of getting it published is also the story of one of the problems in the publishing industry, commercial publishing industry today, which is that if the suits can't find something to grab onto, no matter the quality of the book, really good things don't get published.
You asked earlier if I was worried about in-jokes, and I find that now in promoting the book, there's an attitude that people come at me with, well, we all know Shakespeare is boring and no one really likes him, so how does your book make him interesting? I feel like I love Shakespeare, and yeah, it can be difficult if you're not familiar with the language, but look at the slangs that pop up online, and people learn those easily enough. The language, you can learn it, and you can figure it out, and it's very rewarding if you're a person who loves language. And spending so much time with the sonnets, just the tale of Shakespeare's own heartbreak, Shakespeare is not up on some pedestal, but like he's a close friend who you've sat with while he was going through a really hard time in his life and heartbreak, and he's in love with these two people, and then they've both dumped him and started dating each other. It is a very close relationship I have with my reading of Shakespeare, I guess, my concept of the author, which I think a lot of people who really do genuinely love Shakespeare do come to, which is why they can be very upset when you come at it with a different interpretation than they came up with themselves or than they read in it.
Well, it's also bizarre because you've got dozens of books arguing that Shakespeare was this person or that person, and each one is so invested in who that Shakespeare is. And I look at it and I go, I don't care.
I wrote a paper once that talks about the authorship controversy, but this idea that we do all read our own picture of Shakespeare. We see what is relevant to us, and the Shakespeare we end up coming up with is often a reflection of ourselves as much as the text. This guy from Stratford, he didn't leave much history behind to really put together who he was, so we have to kind of make it up anyway. So even the real Shakespeare, the Shakespeare from Stratford, the official Shakespeare, I guess, is an invention that we all read mostly through his plays.
Well, you did a lot of research on this. It was my understanding, maybe I'm wrong, that up until around 100 years ago, give or take, Shakespeare was just considered one of the playwrights. But it's only been in the last century that he became the supreme playwright, or do I have that wrong?
I think it's a little longer than a century. The Victorians were very into Shakespeare, and even a little bit earlier than that. I guess the 19th century is when the real Shakespeare idolatry is in full force, the bardolatry. But even in the 1670s, William Davenport, when they reopened the playhouses after the Restoration, was bragging that he was the illegitimate son of Shakespeare, and they produced Shakespeare plays then. So he was produced pretty much constantly.
The other thing that's happened, of course, is that, you know, Shakespeare has gone from poetry, either in drama or the sonnets, to kind of a history. So we think that Julius Caesar actually did say the lines that Shakespeare gave him. And then, of course, there's Josephine Tay's idea about Richard III, that Shakespeare was a Tudor propagandist.
Oh, yeah. Well, he had his own motivations for writing things the way he did, and I'm sure propaganda was a lot of it. I don't know that you can read exactly one-to-one correspondence between the plays and things in Shakespeare's life, though, because you have to remember that at the time, theater, well, even now, theater is a collaborative medium, and so the plays we have are the result of what Shakespeare wrote, then rehearsed by the players and perhaps paraphrased by them in strange ways. Perhaps other actors threw in their own two bits here and there. So what we have is the final play, then taken down often by some scribe. The folios were at least authorized by the players who had been in them, so you can be assured that they're reasonably accurate, but it's not like we have Shakespeare's hand, all those pages of scholarship over what might have been just an ink blot or the copier sneezing.
I was in email contact with Stephen Sondheim, and I mentioned to him that Broadway has turned into a place where the only shows that survive, and I was thinking of A Little Night Music, is when you have a movie star. Mm-hmm. His response to that was, that goes back to Shakespeare. People didn't go to see Shakespeare, they went to see Burbage. Do you think that's true?
I think to a certain extent that's true. I mean, the actors and the characters were more prominent than the playwrights, certainly. Shakespeare wasn't considered Shakespeare then. Nowadays, I think it's a little more that people will go to see a Shakespeare play more than just the actor in it, though I'm sure having Jude Law playing Hamlet didn't hurt the box office any.
In looking at your website, I noticed that you had created a video promo for The Lunatic, the Lover, and the Poet. Is that becoming more commonplace? I noticed that John Ray did the same thing.
The book trailer?
Yeah.
I guess it's one of those things that's sort of expected in the publishing industry now, though no one really knows how much good it does.
Were you told to do it?
I wasn't told to, but I was told that if I wanted to create one, that they didn't have anything in the budget for it, of course, but if I wanted to create one myself, I was welcome to. And it makes a good calling card for the book, I think. You can send someone a link, and they're more likely to watch a one-minute clip on YouTube than they are necessarily to go even to the browse inside feature on the publisher's website and read a few pages. So I consider it more of a blurb or commercial for the book than anything else.
I also noticed on the publisher's website a series of discussion questions. Did you have anything to do with that?
Yeah, they asked me to write up a bunch of discussion questions, and I wasn't sure if it was going to be published in the book or what, so I sent a bunch of things that I guess were mostly questions taken from what I'd written about when I did it as my thesis, my master's thesis.
Merlin Hermes, what's craftster.org?
It's a website for crafts and costuming and various, you know, crafty things.
And you've submitted things to them?
Yes, they have a monthly contest where they'll have a theme. So you do a project and then submit pictures and you're right up to the website, and then the members of the website vote on who has the best project, and the monthly winner wins a prize, and I've won a couple of them.
Well, when you're working on crafts, do you see any connection between that sort of work, doing collage art or creating crafts? Do you see any connection between that and your writing?
Writing is, in a way, collecting. You collect images, you collect thoughts, you collect observations and kind of form them together into a new whole. And all of my artwork, my strange art projects, are in a way a reflection of that, of taking what is already there and reconfiguring it into something new, whether it's cutting up pictures to make a collage, or whether it's finding images in Shakespeare's sonnets and putting them together into a novel. In a way, it's sort of like shopping, too. I love to shop, but only in secondhand and thrift stores. I don't like department stores where there's multiples of everything in different sizes. I like to hunt through things and find what kind of comes to me by chance. And so there is an element of collaging what I find around me, both in writing and in my other crafts and arts.
Well, your new book, the one you're working on now, what's the origins of that?
The Diary of Aphra Behn. Aphra Behn was the first professional female playwright in England. She wrote during the Restoration, which was the first time women were on stage as actresses on the London stage. So she wrote some of the female characters who were played by Nell Gwynn, for example. And she had a really interesting life. She was born the daughter of a barber and a wet nurse, so she's very working class, and she's not at all the person you would expect to become a pretty well-known playwright in London. She's fallen somewhat into obscurity now, though you will see her produced now and again, and there's an Aphra Behn Society that meets, I think, every year, every 2 years. How that happened was I'd finished this one historical novel, and I thought, well, I'll write another one that's sort of similar and see if I can sell them together. And I applied for a grant, and I got the grant. And so it was sort of like, oh, I have to write that novel now, since I got the grant from it, from the Arts Council. So I was trying to find a new and interesting approach to it. So I'm doing it as her diary, and it starts when she's 12 years old, and it goes up, you know, through her becoming a playwright. It's sort of Bridget Jones's Diary of the 17th Century, because she just has this delightfully clueless voice, but at the same time, she's got moxie, and she just puts herself in the middle of situations and gets out of them somehow. So she's a fun character to write.
Merlin A. Hermes, one final question about Lunatic Lover and the Poet. The ending of the book, without going into any specifics, is completely different from what happens at the end of the play Hamlet. Did you always know you were going to do that?
I think a lot of people are misreading that chapter, and I think that's partly my fault, because I took out from the beginning an image that would have pointed to that. I think I leave it ambiguous, and I think at the end we see the alternate, what would have happened if Horatio decided not to tell Hamlet about the ghost and to tell the soldiers, just forget about it, it's nothing. But then we see the watch is turned back again, and we come back to the beginning of the chapter before he makes the decision. So I think it's left ambiguous what he actually decides, that when time is put out of joint because the watch is broken, he maybe goes back and makes the other choice. And I think partly a lot of people are missing that, because towards the beginning of an earlier draft, I had something about the watch, of turn the watch forward and you can see the future, turn it back and you can see the past. But that was in one of the revisions when I put it into Horatio's voice, because it wasn't always first person. It was third person, and there was a much more postmodern narrator who commented on the action. But putting it into Horatio's voice, that didn't make sense. So I sort of wonder if I could have made that more clear at the end. But I kind of like leaving it ambiguous, because that way people get to decide for themselves whether the play of Hamlet really occurs, or whether it's just Hamlet's fantasy and Horatio is indulging him by writing this story behind it.
You've been listening to an interview with Merlin A. Hermes, whose latest novel is titled The Lunatic, the Lover, and the Poet, Harper Perennial Trade Paperback. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.